The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, joining us on the phones from Washington, D.C. is Jeff Chester, the Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. The Center for Digital Democracy is a Washington-based nonprofit group active on policymaking concerning the digital destiny of this nation, the Internet, and the broader realm of new technologies. Jeff Chester is a longtime activist on media policy issues and a great writer. He's written widely in popular press on these matters. He has a new book called Digital Destiny, which will be published next year by New Press. Jeff Chester, welcome to Media Matters.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Well, let's just start right in and talk about a couple of the big issues that I think have gotten people's attention in the last couple of years. And I think the one issue that's put media policymaking on the map in the public consciousness in the past 2 years has been the media ownership rules that the Federal Communications Commission attempted to relax in 2003 and that has been stymied. You were involved in that process from the very beginning and were active in publicizing the importance of these rules. Could you give our listeners a little bit of background on what that was about and where it stands now?
Well, I mean, it's appropriate to talk about it during the season because what it was about and is about is simple greed. I mean, you already have these huge companies that dominate the American media landscape, like GE, NBC, Disney, ABC, News Corp, Fox, for example, and they're huge. They have lobbied successfully in Washington for decades, particularly over the last 20 years, so they can own more TV stations, so they can own cable channels, so they can buy satellite systems. They've had an unlimited menu in which to expand their power and holdings, all, of course, without any kind of public interest requirement. But they want more. As a naughty kid might say. And so they have worked over the Federal Communications Commission, which is now run by Michael Powell, the son of Colin Powell. He's a very free market kind of chair. And these biggest media companies, not just the television networks, broadcast television networks, but also major newspaper companies like the Tribune Company, and the cable companies, they're saying, let's get rid of all the rules. What they really have been saying is, we don't think there should be any rules or limits to how much we acquire. If we want to buy every media outlet in your town, if we want to buy any media outlet across the country, that should be okay. And that's what they're still saying. And right after the first of the year, we will find out what some of these big companies are saying to the U.S. Supreme Court, because they want the court to come in and, in fact, tell the lower court, you were wrong. These rules should be thrown away.
And just for a little bit of background for our readers, the lower court threw out the FCC's relaxation of the media ownership rules earlier in 2004, and that's what the Supreme Court would be considering.
That's right. In June of 2003, the Federal Communications Commission, the main U.S. agency that regulates media, proposed a wholesale change in our media policy, in essence allowing these big companies to get bigger. A number of groups went to court, led by an organization called the Media Access Project, and the court last June said, FCC, you really came up with these rules in a terribly flawed way. It makes absolutely no sense. We're saying these rules cannot go into effect. We're sending them all back to you, and you better revise them and do it in a kind of a serious way. So right now, the proposed changes are on hold, and what the big media companies like Fox, Rupert Murdoch's Fox, and the Tribune Company, which owns papers like Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, and Baltimore Sun, what they are likely to tell the court on, I think it's on January 2nd, is, hey, you know, the lower court was wrong. There's no reason to have any limits, and let us buy up whatever we'd like to buy up.
You know, Jeff Chester, you mentioned earlier that you described Michael Powell, the chair of the five-member Federal Communications Commission, as a free market sort of guy. What that's a term he would like to describe himself too. What exactly does free market mean in an industry like telephone, television, radio, cable, internet, where all the main providers get monopoly government licenses? What does that mean?
Well, I use that as shorthand. You know, I mean, really, what Powell simply believes that there should be absolutely, you know, no public policies at all that restrain any of these giants. And you're absolutely right. He fails intellectually to take into consideration that these big media and telecom companies have built up their empire because they were able to engage in special interest lobbying over the decades, you know, with the federal government. So they have built up their monopoly power, sanctioned by the government. And now that they are, you know, bloated empires, they simply want the government to go away and let them grow even larger. So clearly the government has played an important role in allowing these companies to get big. But Michael Powell ignores media history. He's clearly, if he's read the books that you have written and other histories, he clearly has short-term and long-term memory problems. Because he fails to take into account consistently how these big companies were able to achieve their market power. He fails to take into account always how these companies have pledged consistently to serve the public interest and how they have broken every promise. One of my biggest criticisms of Powell's proposal on media ownership was that he simply ignored what was going on within the media industries at the time. When Powell started his deregulatory proposals on September 13th, 2001, 2 days after the 9/11 Washington, and that's right, and in New York, when he declared, we've never had a more diverse and healthy media system in the United States. We've never had a healthier journalism. We can get rid of all of these rules on media ownership. And he did not want to go out and speak to journalists in newspapers or producers in television stations or producers and writers in Hollywood. And if you know what's going on within our media industries today, you know that most people feel they're in a terrible crisis. There are not the resources. There's tremendous pressure so that people cannot do the serious journalism and even the creation of entertainment that this country deserves. Powell simply ignores the realities of the market today and our history.
We're talking to Jeff Chester today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jeff Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy in Washington, D.C., a public interest activist group. You can find out more about the Center for Digital Democracy at www.democraticmedia.org. It's an excellent website. I urge you to go there. Jeff Chester is also the author of a forthcoming book from New Press titled Digital Destiny. This program was recorded a few days before going on air, so please don't call in with questions today. Just sit back and relax, and I assure you, Jeff and I can do all the yakking for everyone in the community today. Jeff, you know, let's assume that the Supreme Court doesn't do anything on the media ownership rules and it doesn't go through the courts any further. This is still going to be a hot issue, will it not, at the FCC again and maybe in Congress?
Well, Michael Powell will do anything in his power to eliminate these safeguards. He is just ideologically opposed to any kind of a public interest safeguard. But I think the real danger here, and where we're going to need your listeners and supporters, is with the Congress. As many of your listeners know, in 1996 there was a tremendous lobbying free-for-all by the various media companies where they just piled on special interest giveaways in what is known as the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that gave away big favors to telephone companies, to broadcast companies, to cable companies. Guess what? That's not enough, apparently. They think that those rules are too stringent. So now, in what is clearly going to be the Washington, D.C. K Street Lobbyist Retirement Act of 2005, these big media companies plan to rewrite our basic telecommunications laws over the next year or two, sweeping away likely critical safeguards that are designed to protect communities, make television, cable, and broadband internet services affordable, that now restrain, even in a terribly modest way, the limits of corporate power that any one media company can wield. All of this is up for grabs as these big media companies intend to throw away what's left of U.S. public interest policy on media.
Well, in 1996, as you said, when the Congress passed the now infamous or famous, depending on one's perspective, Telecommunications Act, it came after maybe 4 or 5 years of intensive work on Capitol Hill, lobbying, all pretty much done behind the scenes without any public discussion or awareness. In fact, you and I were both involved in this back in that period. For a law of such singular importance for setting the terms for our media system and communication systems for generations, it barely registered at all in the public consciousness. It was only covered in the business pages. And as you said, it sailed through and was exactly what you'd expect. It was a grab bag for powerful lobbyists. Do you think it's the nature of debates over media have changed in this country so that it will be a little different this time out?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's because of not only people like you, but hopefully many of your listeners and the millions of people across the country that expressed their concern about big media lobbying that has set the stage for what I think will be a change in the way business is done here in Washington on media. I think for many people, particularly from the liberal progressive perspectives, the coverage of the recent Iraq war and then the aftermath of it has played an important role in waking people up. I mean, it's evident before our eyes the failure of the television networks and of our newspapers in effectively reporting the events that led up to the decision by Bush to invade Iraq and the subsequent coverage. So there's been this massive media failure, and people have made the connection that one reason the press is incapable of providing them with the information they need is because it's tied up to these big media companies trying to curry favor with the Bush administration, et cetera. So there are many new groups that have emerged over the last few years, or groups that are now focused on media for the first time. Foremost comes a group that you're associated with, the Free Press, which is playing an important role all across the country. Common Cause, which has been an organization around now for 30 years, is focused on media issues. There are many other local and national groups that have emerged. So people are working together, and hopefully with the support of your listeners and others, to proactively engage these corporate forces to articulate a public interest vision for democracy and the media in the United States. So the odds against us are great because they have huge resources, but I am confident that we're going to make it a spirited battle.
We're talking to Jeff Chester today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This show was taped a few days before we went on air so that we could take the holiday weekends off and listen to the radio in our homes, just like you. So don't call in today. Let us do the talking. Jeff, you know, we're talking about media policy, media politics, and sort of the growing media reform movement. Some of our listeners are up to speed on this and are well aware of it, but a lot of them probably, like most Americans, haven't really been acquainted with these issues much. Why don't you just for a second explain what the FCC is? I mean, because this is a term we use all the time, but for a lot of Americans, these initials mean very little, and what its relationship is to Congress.
Well, the Federal Communications Commission is the so-called independent branch of the federal government that has responsibility for overseeing the telephone industry and the broadcasting and cable industries. Their power has expanded. They're also responsible for broadcast satellites and internet policy as well. But there are five person commission appointed by the president. Three of the commissioners are the party of the president. So in this case, there are three Republicans right now. Two members of the commission represent the party not in the White House, the Democrats. So it's 3-2, and they allegedly oversee these various industries. However, the Federal Communications Commission, since its inception back in 1934, And there was a predecessor agency for a few years just on radio. But the FCC has long been captured by the special interest. I mean, part of the reason why you cannot get anything decent out of the Federal Communications Commission, no matter who's there, Republican or Democrat, is that there's a kind of golden door, revolving door. These commissioners and senior staff people come in. They know that they want to make the big bucks and work for the very media companies they're now allegedly overseeing or regulating, and they go right out from the FCC right into industry. So if you look, for example, at all the previous living FCC chairs, they're either the key lobbyists working for the media industry today or working for a big media company. So it's a watchdog that's more like a corporate media lapdog.
Now, also, the Federal Communications Commission, so our listeners are clear on this, is not a body like the Supreme Court where members get lifetime appointments and they're supposed to be autonomous of Congress and the White House. They're supposed to not be affected by politics. It's an appointed body with limited terms, and it's supposed to actually carry out the mandate of Congress. I mean, Congress is supposed to set the broad policy that the FCC implements. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, the FCC has tremendous authority on its own to impose rules and regulations on various media matters. Yes, you're right. They have to carry out the will of Congress, and if Congress passes legislation requiring the FCC to do anything specifically, then the commission has to do it. But on its own, they have a huge amount of power and authority. I mean, they're supposed to serve the will of Congress, but they're also supposed to be an independent agency. But what goes on all the time is that powerful members of Congress, and certainly the White House, are on the phone or probably via email telling many of the commissioners, certainly the chair, what to do.
Now, is that a good thing? Are members of Congress more likely to represent the public interest? Are they going to get on the phone and say, stop being lackeys for this commercial interest or that and start caring about the public? Is Congress the progressive force here?
For the most part, even the most liberal member of Congress, with some rare exceptions, toe the corporate media line here. I mean, they might tell the FCC, hey, go easy on this, or et cetera, but they're certainly not going to come out and tell the FCC, either on the record or off the record, vote against the merger of a Comcast, with an Adelphia. Vote against Fox Television, DirecTV, buying the country's biggest satellite service, DirecTV. Vote against the rules favoring the baby bells. I mean, you have this incredible timidity in Congress on these media issues, for the most part, because of the big campaign contributions and, frankly, access to the airwaves and television that these big media companies ply the members of Congress with.
At the same time, Jeff, it seems like members of Congress, it's easier for them to locate their spine if they sense that there's votes for them, or there could be penalties that they'll face at the polls if they don't serve the public, sometimes if the public gets active on an issue.
That would be ideal. Look, there's a lot of work being done on constituency building here, and certainly members of Congress are taking notice. But I think there's a long road to hoe. Now, there was some opposition to the media ownership rules passed by the Bush FCC in Congress, but one reason why they had political support in Congress was that the television lobby itself was at odds with what some of the networks were doing. So there's a real question here in my mind about how strong the public is represented in terms of Congress on these issues, but I think that increasingly more and more people recognize that the whole future of our electronic media system is at stake. The laws passed in a number of states that prevent, for example, local communities from either establishing their own internet service or places where citizens have created their own community network. The fact that the bell companies and the cable companies are going around to prevent people from establishing their own internet services has served as a wake-up call for many more people. And so I'm hoping we're going to be able to build those constituencies that will convince Congress, but I don't think we're there yet.
We're talking to Jeff Chester today in Media Matters. Again, this show is taped a few days before we're going on air, so sit back, relax, don't call in. Jeff Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. You can find out about the Center for Digital Democracy at www.democraticmedia.org. He has a book coming out next year with New Press called Digital Destiny, which I am sure is going to be a landmark work based on Jeff's many years of work on media policy and considering implications for the internet. We're talking today on Media Matters about the broad realm of media policy activism and the crucial issues facing the country today and going into the future. Jeff, one of the really striking developments along the lines of what we've been talking about, increasing public involvement, started in 2003, and something you were intimately connected to, that Federal Communications Commission, in an unprecedented, historically unprecedented gesture, going around the country and holding a series of public hearings to get public input on the idea of relaxing media ownership rules or what the public thinks media ownership ought to be for broadcasters, the sort of appropriate rules. And it was really quite an extraordinary phenomenon. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because you were involved at the creation of that.
Yes. Before I do, I'd like to just briefly touch on one of the themes of the book. Because
sure.
I think, your listeners might be interested in it. I mean, all these changes that are going on with our electronic media system, the emergence of the internet and new developments in cable and satellite television. The industry is focused on harnessing all of those powerful technologies to make a much more effective mechanism for advertising. And I think that, to me, underscores why it's so important that we have as much activism and public participation to ensure that there's a part of our media system, our electronic media system, whose mission is to sort of serve the highest aspects of our democratic culture, whether it's related to our politics or related to creativity and entertainment. The goal that the big media companies have in mind with the internet and with cable television, et cetera, is to literally be able to deliver commercials and commercial messages to individuals. I mean, we've seen that as the basic business model online. It's called one-to-one marketing, but it's really being fully incorporated into the architecture, into the technology, and into the programming vision that the big media companies have for the future of television and for the internet. It's going to track and collect all kinds of data about us. There's going to be sophisticated databases attached to that data, and then we'll be seeing a commercial in a show that our neighbor next door doesn't see. And, of course, it's not just through our television or just through the computer at home. It's going to be this kind of ubiquitous mobile marketing system here that follows us, particularly young people who use wireless communication. So we're going to have a much more commercially oriented marketing culture, and we have to fight that. But I actually think it's inevitable. I'm afraid, because they are so far ahead in terms of what they are doing. But it underscores why we have to fight to make sure that there are some limits on their power, and we have the kind of non-commercial and civic and independent alternatives, where people are simply not trying to pitch to us on a 24/7 basis. And that's really the theme of my book. It's both as a warning call and as a sort of documentation about what they're doing.
And I think what you're making the argument just here and in your book and in all your work is that there's been a large segment of Americans, or a significant segment at least, that has believed that, there are all these problems with Sinclair Broadcasting and Clear Channel and News Corporation gobbling up all the media and using it to sort of promulgate their political views. But we don't really need to worry, because we can go online, we can do our blogs, we can see our friends' websites, we can do move on emails to all our friends, and we can sort of ignore all that stuff and live in blissful happiness sort of with a democratic media system we make ourselves. We can make our own media. We can just sort of bypass and leapfrog all that other stuff. And you're saying that the technology doesn't have that magical power.
I am saying that some of the most powerful forces in our culture, and indeed in our world, Time Warner, you know, and Comcast and the television networks, backed by Silicon Valley, backed by Madison Avenue, are creating and deploying this interactive, you know, marketing system that is, is going to be a reality in our lives, and we cannot ignore that. I mean, you know, if foremost. Second, I personally don't believe that we can bypass this system, that we have to sort of face it and fight it and attack it. And third, I'm concerned that the kind of special interest lobbying these companies are doing, it's not just saying, I want to buy as much old media as I want, cable television and newspapers and broadcast stations. They are changing the rules on how the Internet itself has been governed and structured so that the biggest cable and telephone companies, for example, are placing themselves now in a preferential way to control the future of the Internet.
I mean, explain how they're going to do that, Jeff.
Well, the and they've done it. So when you see what their business model is, okay, this kind of powerful, interactive, personalized commercial system, when you see that they're wiping away both the old media ship safeguards and eliminating new media ownership safeguards, which I'll talk about in a minute, so that they dominate the distribution system for electronic media, people like me then get worried. Ah, here's their business model, and they're wiping out competition, and they're controlling the lines of distribution. That's going to be a very formidable thing to fight. Well, what the Internet developed in part because it was designed to be what people call an open network. The Internet was designed to rest on the telephone lines, and those lines have been regulated as open networks, called common carrier. The important principle there has been that the company that delivered you with the telephone communications or the Internet access for dial-up has been prohibited from discriminating against any content. They can't slow down your telephone call. They're not supposed to speed up your telephone call. They're supposed to be just neutral, send all that communications back and forth. And in addition, as a result of the 1996 Telecom Act, one positive thing that came out of it was that other companies could connect to the basic telephone network. That's why you have 7,000, 8,000 Internet service providers. So today we have an Internet whose DNA is one of diversity. There are 8,000 different companies offering you connections to the Internet. Some of them are small mom and pop, community, nonprofit. Some of them are huge, like Earthlink and Microsoft. And more importantly, they are prohibited from discriminating against you. Well, both the cable and the telephone industry, the baby bells, looked at the Internet and saw that it was an important way for them to extend their current monopoly over either cable television and telephone into the new Internet world. So what did the big telephone and cable companies do? They have lobbied the same Michael Powell FCC to wipe away the rules which require that ISPs can have access to you as a customer. They've lobbied the FCC to wipe away this critical safeguard on non-discrimination, which means that the biggest cable companies and the biggest phone companies are in control of the last mile of the Internet. That connection that comes to your home, they can start slowing stuff up, they can start speeding stuff up, and you can be sure that they're going to do their best to push that business model, that kind of interactive advertising business model. They're going to control the content, etc. So I am concerned, and that's going to be the dominant Internet for most people, what the phone companies and cable companies provide.
We're talking to Jeff Chester today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Jeff Chester, Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy in Washington, D.C., and he is the author of a new book, Digital Destiny, which will be published next year by New Press. And we've been talking about the issues discussed in Digital Destiny, the future of the Internet here on the show. Please don't call in today. This show is recorded a few days before we're going on air, so let Jeff and yours truly do the yakking today. Jeff, you know, you talked about how just now, the sort of we've got sort of Hyman Roth and Michael Corleone, these two dominant industries, the telephone companies and the cable companies that have these wires the last mile into the home, and they have duopoly control in effect over Internet access for most Americans. You also alluded earlier a few minutes ago to this movement to set up community wireless broadband access that's going on around the country that's mushrooming. We have a system right here in Urbana. You know, the movement to try to break that duopoly. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, absolutely. The big cable and telephone companies have now positioned themselves because of favorable regulation and lobbying in Washington to be the dominant provider. So very soon, you know, the other ISPs like Earthlink that people might use will not be able to have access to providing you with internet service. They are opposed to not only commercial competition, but they are opposed to any other form of service that would challenge their internet dominance. That's why the big telephone companies and some big cable companies like Comcast are going community by community or state to state to pass legislation or to undermine efforts that would that communities might have their own networks to serve the public. There are places like in Champaign, Urbana, as you said, and in other places like Philadelphia, where they're working on creating alternative community networks. I mean, communities can provide internet broadband access today much more effectively, much more inexpensively than commercial providers. But the big cable and phone companies simply don't want any competition, whether it's commercial or non-commercial, so they're trying to lobby them out of existence.
What can people listening to this show and when people listen to your talks when you talk around the country or when readers of your articles, what can they do to plug in to try to work on this issue to keep alive alternative access to the Internet and competition in these markets?
Well, first of all, there's going to be a very important Supreme Court case this spring. A number of us have taken the FCC rules on the future of the Internet to court. We've won in the lower court, but the Bush administration, backed by the big cable lobby, asked the Supreme Court to hear the case, and it's called the Brand X case. And no, it's not you know, something that Michael Powell wants to impose a decency fine on. Brand X is the name of a small internet service provider based in Santa Monica, California, and it's one of the plaintiffs with us in the case. So people should certainly follow that case here in the Media Access Project in Washington, which is mediaaccess.org, is helping to do the legal work on that case. But we should be trying to create and support as many community networks as possible, and you know, without making it sound like a self-serving plug for you, or the best resource, I think, is the Free Press website, MediaReform.net, that has a wonderful series of resources on wireless and community broadband. I mean, there are other organizations as well, but we have to not only fight their lobbying efforts, which I want to talk about in a moment, but we have to try to encourage cities to create these new approaches to provide everyone with internet access in the country.
We'll go ahead and talk about it now, then. Those lobbying efforts.
Well, look, there's more at stake here. I mean, it's not just providing your communities with access to the Internet and other kinds of related services, because if you bring folks a competition for the Internet, you can also bring cable television and telephone services, et cetera. It's about the whole role that communities, local governments, should and can play in helping ensure that the people within their municipalities, their areas, gain some of the benefits of modern communications. Phone companies and cable companies want to sweep away, and they're going to go to state legislatures and Congress next year to do it. These companies want to sweep away the ability of local governments to require what's known as a franchise. That's a contract. So before a cable company or a phone company can come in and build that cable TV system or build that telephone network, they're supposed to provide some resources for the city. They're supposed to provide public access channels for local communities to use. They're supposed to give some access to the power of this important internet technology to the communities. The big cable and phone companies don't want to see any kind of local control over these broadband networks, and they're going to go to Congress and ask that franchising be deregulated, in essence. So getting involved with some of the groups, whether it's Free Press or Media for Democracy or Reclaim the Media or Media Tank, there are many good groups out there, and helping them fight off this attack on the, how the Internet can serve our democracy is a critical task.
We're talking to Jeff Chester today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you the day after Christmas, Boxing Day in the British Commonwealth. And we're talking about Jeff's work with the Center for Digital Democracy, which is located at www.democraticmedia.org. He's the author of a new book, Digital Destiny, which will be published next year by New Press. And Jeff Chester, you have probably been as active in the field of media reform politics as almost anyone for many years now on the West Coast and now in Washington for the past, what, 10 or 12 years?
Yep, 12 years.
And you've seen this movement, I think, really grow and blossom. You're one of the real founders of the modern movement, so it's an honor to have you on our program today. One of the other issues you've been very active on, Jeff, I want to talk about is public broadcasting. Public broadcasting in this country, PBS, NPR, the station we're on now, which is an NPR affiliate, has been, in the midst of sort of funding problems and crises, especially on the television side at PBS. And, there are efforts now to try to somehow stabilize the funding and create a stronger and healthier public broadcasting system in this country. What's your take on this?
Well, I think, one of the most important issues for us to tackle is how do we create this kind of non-commercial culture? Will there be any kind of non-commercial culture in our society? During the early part of the 21st century, I've already described that we're going to have a much more powerful, intrusive, commercialized one. I mean, will there be a commons? Will there be some kind of safe haven for us where we're not being pitched to 24/7? Now, public broadcasting was, of course, supposed to be our sort of non-commercial alternative in the television era, but little by little, in part because they never fully funded it, in part because of its leadership. Public broadcasting, or television in particular, is highly commercial. It's never been able to fulfill its potential. Public radio is somewhat on better footing, where NPR, provides, serious news for the public. But public television simply has been incapable of really generating any kind of serious non-commercial alternative. Well, public broadcasting officials, public television officials have always claimed that the real problem is money. Now, I don't agree with them. I think it's a combination of vision and money. But public television says if you gave us the money, we would create a serious public non-commercial television alternative. Well, as some of your listeners may know, television stations are supposed to go digital in this country. The U.S. television stations, commercial and non-commercial, have been given a free set of airwaves, it's called the spectrum, from the government to start broadcasting their transmissions in digital. That will make it a better picture with better sound. And by the way, it's the foundation for the kind of interactive advertising, in part, that I described earlier, once they're able to go digital. But public television stations have also gotten this free spectrum and are supposed to convert to digital. Well, when they return their old channel, so to speak, back to the federal government. I know it's a little complicated and technical, but when they, you know, it's either analog or digital, and if they go digital, the part of the airwaves that's not digital can be returned to the federal government, and the federal government wants to sell it because these big telephone companies, wireless companies, mobile communication companies all want to get a piece of the airwaves because there's so much money to be made. Well, there's going to be billions and billions of dollars coming into the federal coffers as these old airwaves are sold off. And we can talk about whether or not they should be sold off or not, but public broadcasting says we should get a piece of the money. Show me the money. You know, they're sitting looking over the shoulder of Don Corleone and all those people saying, give us a little scrap, because it's billions of dollars worth of public funding they want.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have just unveiled in the middle of December a kind of, I wouldn't call it a blue-red ribbon panel chaired by the former head of Netscape, a guy named James Barksdale, and then also the former chairman of the FCC, a guy named Reed Hunt. But they've created this new committee that's going to recommend by March how public television can get some of these billions and billions of dollars. But I fear that they might get the money, but frankly they'll continue doing business as usual. We'll just keep seeing antique roadshow with higher priced antiques, unless we can get the public to say, hey, I want to see a serious commitment for non-commercial programming. I want to see more investigative reporting, more news programming, more local programming, children's programming without all those underwriting commercials. I mean, so PBS is trying to get a grab of the digital pie, but I have questions about whether or not it's really going to benefit us.
Now, once again, this is the sort of issue that's not getting a lot of press coverage or media coverage, so most Americans aren't familiar that there are these pretty fundamental debates about the future of public broadcasting going on in Washington, of these high-level commissions that are negotiating with members of Congress and perhaps industry and the FCC. What can citizens who care about having viable, strong, nonprofit, non-commercial broadcasting in this country do rather than be spectators and to shows like this?
Absolutely. And one of the criticisms that were made as PBS unveiled this new initiative in the middle of December was, why are you having these meetings that are not public? I mean, why are you doing this behind closed doors? Let alone, you know, why aren't you organized to think about how we could really have a true non-commercial telecommunications system in this country instead of appearing to just want to give a handout to PBS and the largest stations? Well, you're right, it's behind closed doors, and I'm hoping that your listeners and others, will focus on this and get involved and provide testimony to this new Blue Ribbon panel. I would ask, without being self-serving, they could come to my website here. There's a public broadcasting newspaper called Current, C-U-R-R-E-N-T, and if they go to current.org, they can get for free, if they have online access, a lot of the most recent articles and information about this committee. But it's under the radar screen. It's an issue that deserves to be at the foremost of the public attention, and I'm hoping all the groups concerned about media will focus on it. We should not allow PBS to walk away with billions without ensuring that it truly benefits everyone in our society.
Jeff, let's go back to the issue I raised a while before we jumped into the internet stuff, which were these FCC public hearings, because it really ties to a lot of the themes that you've been talking about today, which is how the policies for the internet, for media ownership, for public broadcasting are made at the elite level, oftentimes dominated exclusively by powerful, wealthy corporate special interests, with almost no public involvement, even though the eventual system directly affects the quality of public life in the United States. And what took place in 2003, which was historically unprecedented, was a series of public hearings where for the first time the FCC did what you hoped this PBS Blue Ribbon Commission would do, went around the country and let average people, normal people, regular people who aren't connected to the industry, aren't investors, just come up and give their opinion of the role media play in their community and what they think of changing media ownership rules or what sort of media system they'd like. And it was really a revolutionary, in many ways, a way of doing media policymaking. You were sort of present at the creation of these hearings. Talk a little bit about them.
Well, I do think that it's an important topic because some of your listeners, you know, might be interested that there's going to be a whole new set of these public hearings. There's I don't know what will come out of it, but because of changes in congressional leadership, there are new there's a new chairman and a ranking member of the Senate Commerce Committee, that very powerful committee that decides media policy in the Senate. It was chaired by John McCain. Now it's going to be chaired by Republican Senator Ted Stevens. And the what they call the ranking Democrat, the number one Democrat on the committee, is Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii, who's now replaced Ernest Hollings. So there's a whole new leadership, so to speak, an old leadership in the Senate. And they just announced they're going to do a 10-city tour in the next year to sort of get the pulse of the public, which will likely be dominated by corporate lobbyists unless we can counter-organize. Well, when Michael Powell proposed in 2003 the greatest changes to public policy in terms of media ownership in decades, when he proposed getting rid of rules that restrain somewhat how many outlets in a community and across the country one company can own, he did not want to make this a public event. He wanted to do this behind closed doors. He finally decided to do one hearing only. And now you cannot, and you should not, if you're going to make proposals that fundamentally affect the way the public gets information and entertainment, affecting how we live in our localities and how we live as a nation, this needs to be public and debated across the nation. And we are very fortunate that for the first time in many years, there actually are two good Democrats at the Federal Communications Commission. I mean, I've been very critical of the Democrats in the past, and particularly in the Clinton era. I mean, they were almost as bad as the Republicans, reflecting really the interests of the corporate agenda. For the most part, but for a number of reasons, you have a person who may have been on the show before, Michael Cox.
Yeah, Michael's been on the show,
and then also Jonathan Adelstein. So you had two good Democrats who, frankly, were appalled about what they were seeing in terms of the lack of public participation, and they said they would travel. And frankly, I don't think have ever said this publicly before. But what we did was, a number of groups working together, writers' union, journalists' union, music groups, we all came together and said, well, if the FCC under Powell won't have these public hearings, we will create these hearings. And we sort of worked behind the scenes to get universities across the country to initially agree to host these hearings, because that's the only way that Cops and Adelstein would agree to come if we're so-called neutral convener. And we raised the money to hold these hearings, and then others began doing the hearings ourselves. So it really was the public interest groups that created the hearings. I mean, the irony that it was the poorly funded public interest groups that had to create, not just for political purposes, though that was the key goal, but really to ensure some kind of minimal public participation. We created the public forums that the FCC should have done on their own.
And these hearings, I mean, it's difficult to exaggerate the effect they had, I think, on the media ownership fight in 2003 and going forward, because in almost every case you had standing room only crowds, hundreds, even over 1,000 people, and it's just hanging from the rafters, going hour and hour after hour all over the country talking to Cops and Adelstein. And the sentiment being very strongly in favor of having more media owners, not fewer, more localism, not less, less commercialism, more journalism. The message is repeated from people across the political spectrum as well. It was, I think, for both Cops and Adelstein, from my understanding, this was really an epiphany.
It was, and that underscores why, for your listeners and supporters, why participating in those public hearings that will emerge in next year or two is so important. Because, these members of the commission are under a lot of pressure. And there's in politics in Washington, there are these forces to sort of get along and accommodate. And I can tell you that it was the outpouring of public sentiment at these hearings that literally made a difference in how some of these people conceptualized the issue, and it solidified their political support for the public interest. So they played a very important role here in frankly generating opposition at the FCC to what Michael Powell wanted to do.
We're talking to Jeff Chester today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jeff Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy. You can learn about that at www.democraticmedia.org. He has a new book coming out next year called Digital Destiny, which will be published by New Press. Let me remind you that 1 week from today, our guest will be David Brock, the executive director of Media Matters for America. 2 weeks from today, our guest will be Juliet Shore, the author of Born to Buy. Please join us for both shows. If you would like to get a weekly email update on what the contents of the show will be, with links to our authors, articles, and books and organizations, please send an email to our producer, Victor Picard. His address is vpicard@uiuc.edu. That's vpicard@uiuc.edu. We'll send you a weekly email update. We won't send anything but once a week. We do not give away the email addresses. You can get off the list as soon as you want. We have hundreds of people who currently get it, and I think they're delighted to get it. Plus, there's an archive link for all the old shows if you want to go listen to any of our old shows on your computer. So please do that if you're interested. Jeff Chester, we've only got, a couple minutes left, and there's so much still to talk about. But I'd like to ask you one question to conclude, because it's a central question that I think a lot of Americans ask, and I know you get it, and I'd like to hear what you say to this question. They'll say, the First Amendment of the Constitution basically says the government should keep its hands off media. And yet all this talk you're doing, all these policies you're proposing, is all about having the government intervene and regulate the communication system. Doesn't that violate the First Amendment?
Well, the First Amendment was also written to protect the rights of the public, of the citizens and those who are part of the democracy, to make sure they had access to information, particularly access to information so that they could play an active role in keeping their government accountable. And that's how they've developed these safeguards. It's about restraining the power of any one particular company or industry to control the information that we have that's so important if we're going to make more informed decisions, and if we're going to have a kind of equitable democracy where the public has more rights than a handful of big corporate giants. There's a balance here, and I think the advocates are concerned about that balance, about which is why many of us are opposed to the FCC imposing these quote-unquote indecency fines on some of our political opponents like Fox. So we're trying to create a balance, but it's particularly important for the digital age, between private rights and public rights, between commercial and non-commercial, between a media system that enhances our lives as community members and as citizens, and also facilitates economic growth. So it's not one thing or another.
Well, Jeff Chester, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters. You're doing great work, and let's stay in touch. When the new book comes out, please be back in touch. We'll get you back on the air.
Appreciate you and your listeners' interest.
Okay, listeners, I'll see you all in 167 hours. Have a great holiday season.
If you're considering which tax-deductible contributions you'll make this last week of 2004, we hope you'll remember how important listener support is to the strength of WILL's program service. If you've not contributed this year, please write a check to the Friends of WILL Radio and mail it before December 31st to the University of Illinois Foundation, Box 3429, Champaign 61826. Thank you, and best wishes for a happy new year.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with the high in the mid-20s and north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low 9 to 14 degrees and north winds around 5 miles per hour this evening, shifting to the east after midnight. Tomorrow, partly sunny with the high in the upper 20s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 2 p.m. Central Time, a prairie